Welcome to this session on the last day of September, September 30th, 2013. Pleased to have you here. And Roy Giel is going to make a presentation today. He's a professor of religion at Booth University College in Winnipeg, Canada. He got his PhD from the University of Sheffield, England, and his teaching focuses on biblical studies and biblical hermeneutics. But he reads widely and also occasionally reviews films as well as scholarly books. And most recent go-round was with Stieg Larsson's trilogy on the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, where he wrote reviews of the books and then the relation of the films to the books. So this is a special side of his. In 2010... his very important edited book on human sexuality and nuptial mystery that he edited focused on imagery surrounding marriage and the nuptial relation of human bodies. And this has been only a part of his leadership in the arena of visual exegesis and rhetorography in the Rhetoric of Religious Antiquity Research Group. His essay on clothes make the woman, and he put woe in the woman, clothes make the man, clothes make the woman, which he delivered at the Rhetoric Conference in Pretoria, South Africa, and then appeared in 2005, led the way within our group at that time by focusing on Paul's rhetorical presentation of being clothed with a person, putting on a person, namely being clothed with Christ. A very interesting language in four of Paul's letters, or letters attributed to Paul in the New Testament. This initial work launched Professor Giel on a full-length socio-rhetorical commentary on Paul's letter to the Colossians, which he'll be completing within the next year, because in the midst of that work, he completed an essay entitled Blending Two Arts, Rhetorical Pictures and Social Formation, in the letter to Philemon, the little letter about slavery and the slave. And this established a foundation for his approach to rhetorography and pictorial narration that he's taken in really this magisterial commentary he's just now completing on Paul's letter to Philemon. He led a stunning 2.5-hour session at the Society of Biblical Literature meeting in Chicago on Philemon just last November. And he'll be putting the finishing touches on this commentary within the next few months. It's almost completed. His presentation this morning on visual interpretation, blending rhetorical arts in Colossians 2:6 through 3:4, places recent cognitive science on visualization in the brain in the context of observations as early as Aristotle that were emphasized later, he feels, by Ezra Pound and expanded there, and take us then to highly interesting emphases within recent work of Daniel Kahneman. He's primarily in this session going to put this theory in practice with the text of Colossians. He's going to have introduction, theoretical, but trying to put it into practice. And one of the special things I wanted to achieve with this session is to have Professor Brigitte Kahl, who is here, with her pictorial, visual, really triumph of a book on the letter to Galatians, with Professor Giel's interpretation of Colossians, where they're both extensively using images from the Roman Empire and emperor language, etc., in their interpretation of them. They have seen each other at a previous SBL meeting, but they really haven't had a chance to engage with each other in detail on specific images as they arise from the text itself. Because here we're exploring interpretation, in this instance, of Christian texts in the context of the Roman world and its visual imagery before Christian art. And then when we move into the Sawyer Seminar, this approach to text before Christian art is being paired with the presentation of someone who's doing visual exegesis from Christian art to biblical text. And that's what we're setting up in this whole sequence. So we want to welcome you, Roy, very much. I'm so pleased that you got here safely from Winnipeg. We had a wonderful session yesterday afternoon with Brigitte, and we look forward to this interaction this morning.
Well, thank you for your very generous introduction. It's very kind. I'm grateful. It's an honor for me to be here and meet with all of you and talk about some things. So, yes, I want to say some things about Colossians after first, because this kind of goes in two parts, as Vernon has really said. The first part is sort of a theory of doing this, as I have come to it so far, at least. There's more to do. And then I want to actually look at a passage in Colossians to describe how this visual exegesis or visual interpretation, how visuality might come out of reading the text. What I don't actually do here, I do it elsewhere but not here, is get to the intertextual stuff with say, Roman art or inscriptions or that sort of thing. On these passages in other places. And what I think I'll do, I've got piles of material here, so I want to work through this introductory stuff about visuality, and then probably I'll just read a section which would be chapter 2 of Colossians 11 to 15 and try to talk about the visuality that I think I see coming out of that. But I begin with a photograph four photographs actually, which I think are interesting, just as a means of starting discussion and getting at the idea of how biblical texts may result in visual things, in artistic things. So this is Moses. Oh. And you will remember the story of Moses at the burning bush, has an encounter with God who is reveals himself as Yahweh, and then Moses is told, you are supposed to go back to Egypt and give the message, let my people go, and all that story. And Moses enters into a kind of a debate with God. And so he says, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? And he says, if I come to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your ancestors has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? But suppose, Moses says, they don't believe me or listen to me, but they say, the Lord did not appear to you. And Moses again says, oh my Lord, I've never been eloquent, neither in the past nor even now that you've spoken to your servant, but I am slow of speech and slow of tongue. Oh my Lord, please send someone else. So these are statues by an artist called Leo Mall, who lived from 1915 to 2009. Many of his works in many places in the world, actually, these happen to be in a park in Winnipeg, in Canada, where I live, which is where Leo Mall actually lived for most of his life. He was an immigrant from the Ukraine, but lived most of his life there. So this is his Moses statue. But the thing is that this work is coming out of Maul reading the text. This is what he sees, and Moses is talking to God and saying, no, not me, I don't think so. He's the story.
So being fairly eloquent all the time.
Yes, claiming he's not, but being eloquent. Yeah. Yes, uh-huh. Yes. Exactly. So there, as you can see, there are actually two statues. This one is, I'd say, about 2 meters tall, and it was actually the first model for this one, which is the final one, which is probably 4 meters tall, maybe 12 feet tall, something like that. And you can see they're a little bit different, but one is the model and one is the finished product, and they're both there. So what we might wish for and aim for based on a historical critical paradigm would be certainty, or at least a high level of certainty. We want to understand reality. But reality, rather like human life, is a very slippery kind of thing, and things cannot be easily grasped, and they move off frequently in uncontrolled and unexplainable directions that are both wondrous and troubling at the same time. What we have to do, therefore, is what we always do. That is to say, we interpret. We have to interpret. And Moses is interpreted by Leo Mall as innumerable images have been used to interpret the Bible or part of it. And we must interpret, at least in part, by considering the imagery that the scriptural text, biblical text, evoke in listeners' and readers' minds. So that's kind of just my sort of starting comment. But here's kind of how where I'm beginning to describe where I think I'm coming from. Visible written texts, which are comprised of recognizable letters of alphabets shaped into words and grammaticalized into clauses, sentences, and paragraphs, and the sounds that correspond to the words, sentences, and paragraphs, when they are read aloud or heard, are things that we learn to understand from childhood onward. What we see in texts with our eyes or hear with our ears is interpreted by our minds to have meaning, meaning values that can be articulated. When people read or listen to literature of all kinds, like novels or stories, poetry, fiction, nonfiction, letters perhaps, technical materials, whatever it is, biblical texts even, they're drawn into the visuality, into what amounts to the visual art of the text. And so we see scenes and visualize persons and places and things, and we hear sounds and notice colors. We visualize and hear and feel the emotions, while in fact we are, you know, looking at funny black marks on a white background, like so. And so these things contribute to our understanding of the text and the information or the meaning it conveys. The written art of words, and I think that the words, even graphically, physically, like letters of the alphabet on a page, I imagine as a kind of art. So I like creating, you know, new fonts. This is an artistic thing, even. So the written art and the visual art, the pictures, intersect in the mind, in the visual imagination. But the visual space in the imagination is often blurred or muted because interpreters become conditioned to analyze the words and avoid the images. It's almost like it's trained into us sometimes, as biblical scholars at least, to analyze the words and ignore or even avoid the images that are evoked in the mind. And so content can become separated from form. But there's still spaces of rhetorical blending. One author who's a friend of mine, he's an artist actually, he talks about the intermedia of words and pictures. Intermedia of words and pictures. And these things call us to examination and analysis. And so texts themselves are visual things that, when they are most effective, evoke or cause the mind to recall the visual. And interpretation of the imagery is, I suppose, what we might call visual exegesis, which is kind of the title of this Sawyer seminar. So there are lots of questions to ask in doing this, but I suggest that there are some particularly important questions, like where does the visual evoked by the text take people? What is the visual meant to do? How can interpreters go about their interpretive task? And so I think those are pretty basic but kind of overarching questions. So what I'm trying to do, I guess I already said this, was first to try to lay a kind of at least an introductory theoretical foundation for the visual in biblical New Testament texts, remembering Moses from the Old Testament, of course. And then to present a visual description and interpretation from Colossians chapter 2. So that's the task today. And what I'm interested in doing is trying to see what images a biblical text places in the imagination and what the images do and where they lead. So the text itself is, in our case today at least, the primary source and the conveyor of images that would be recognized or understood or visualized by audience. So I'm not making those intertextual connections with other things. So first I come to Aristotle. And in the Rhetoric, Aristotle speaks of employing metaphors that set things before the eyes. So in speech, in persuasive language, Aristotle is saying this is the thing. Use metaphors to set things before the eye. So this visual aspect to it. And he goes on to say, he says, I mean that things are set before the eyes by words that signify actuality. Now, actuality is the word given in the Loeb version, but in Greek it's energeia, which means something like activity, energy, working, function, action. Energeia means those kinds of things.
Signify actuality. Yeah. Actuality is energeia.
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 Yeah.
Energeia.
Yeah.
Like energy.
Like energy.
Energy.
Yeah. So, energeia, activity, energy, working, function, action. Those kinds of words might be good for energeia, but the Loeb version gives actuality. So words convey actuality, and metaphor should be set before the eyes. Aristotle goes on to give a series of examples, but his idea, I think, is explained in the next point, and that is that words give movement to and life to all, and actuality or energeia is movement. And there you can see it in Greek with the kinesis is movement, as in kinetics or kinesiology or something like that. So words give movement to life, words do. And actuality is movement. It's actually alive, it's moving, it's doing things in the way that it works. And then when he goes on to, actually it's a previous section in the Rhetoric of the same part of the book three, when he wants to talk about style, which is lexis, he says style evokes fantasia. Fantasia. That is to say, a show, an impression, an appearance in the imagination in order to make things clear or visible. And he says, this is for the sake of the listener, for the sake of the audience, so that the audience understands something. So this fantasia, this visual kind of thing. So in Aristotle's view, rhetoric and words and literature elicit visual images in the mind that are linked, indeed necessary, to understanding, belief, and action or behavior. These things.
Roy, what is the word used for imagination? Do you happen to? What does he say for imagination? Appearance in the imagination. What is that for him?
Well, good question. I don't.
Yes, I'm very sorry.
I
don't see it.
I just thought you had to agree.
I only have that line. I don't have the rest of it.
No. When you think of the product, which is the idola.
Something like.
Fantasia also. I mean, in the Renaissance later, it becomes also a word for the imagination.
Interesting. I thought that was the word for imagination, but I was wondering whether that's another one. So fantasia, that's interesting.
In fact, the word, or the root word, comes up later. I'll refer to Ezra Pound a while, and it's exactly the terminology that Ezra Pound uses.
In when he talks about imagism. And
yes,
the image.
Exactly.
Yes.
Fatal
yes.
Poea, he calls
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
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 Uh-huh.
Yeah.
No, it is.
All right. So then later, Quintilian comes along in the Institutes,
uh-huh.
and he says things very like this. And he begins here, the prime essentials for stirring emotions in others is, in my opinion, first to feel those emotions in oneself. Consequently, if we wish to give our words the appearance of sincerity, we must assimilate ourselves to the emotions of those who are generally so affected, and our eloquence must spring from the same feeling that we desire to produce in the mind of the judge. So, how do you do this, then, would be an obvious question to Quintilian. How can these emotions be produced? And so he goes on to say, there are certain experiences which the Greek call phantasiae, and the Romans, vision, whereby things absent are presented to our imaginations with such extreme vividness that they seem actually to be before our very eyes. And then from such impressions arises that energeia. So this is the language of Aristotle that he seems to be picking up on. From that arises that energeia, which Cicero calls illumination and actuality, which makes us seem not so much to narrate as to exhibit the actual scene, while our emotions will be no less actively stirred than if we were present at the actual occurrence, as if you were there. So, very interestingly, when we go back to Aristotle in his work De Anima or Peri Psuches on the soul, this seems to come up again, and so kind of a bit of a comparison between the rhetoric and De Anima is actually quite helpful. In De Anima, Aristotle claims that sight is the most developed sense. Now, he does, of course, admit there are other senses which are important, in there, but sight is the most developed sense in Aristotle's theory. And then he comes here again to phantasia, which is brought on primarily by visual perception. It conveys understanding to the mind and indeed to the soul. Phantasia brings what is not seen in visual reality to the human mind in the visual imagination. These are my words, not Aristotle's. By it, things are interpreted to be meaningful, to be right or wrong, and it is critical to perception, deliberation, and understanding.
Can you tell me again the exact verse we had before? It was 3...
3.11. 3.11.6.
In Aristotle,
something.
There they are. All from book 3.
3.16.
3.11.
That last one.
3.16.
That's where he begins talking about style.
Yeah.
So things are interpreted to be meaningful, right or wrong, and it's critical to perception, deliberation, and understanding. Now, an objection might be raised, and probably should be raised, because it seems clear that phantasia and the human mind will not always see things correctly, and things could be distorted. One might be misled in picturing something. I mean, you might get the wrong picture as you're reading a text or listening to someone. Because the human mind supplies, sometimes mistakenly, things not actually there, or leaves out things that are there.
Mm-hmm.
This happens.
The word for imagination is fantasia. There, that's repeated.
Yes, okay.
That's why you didn't repeat it in the text.
Okay.
But there's also that distinction, and I mean, this is perhaps more Plato than Aristotle, between imago and eidola. That is that exactly that which is misleading, sharp and clear and vivid,
yes.
Possessing energia, but a false energia as opposed to the copy, which is merely a second-order reality, the imitation. because you, that
which
opens
will be
that
the
up
imago.
Too.
Imago is the proper,
is the
imago, yes,
is
and
the,
idola
is the, fake.
Is the false, the spurious,
yeah.
The,
okay.
The species that is clear beyond clarity.
All right,
mm-hmm.
All right. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's very helpful. But what I'm suggesting in interpretation, recognizing that sometimes we get things wrong, is not necessarily a bad idea. In fact, it may be helpful, because it's one thing it's telling us at least is that our minds are not passive. We are actually doing things. We actually are interpreting, even if we don't get everything right.
Well, right.
And so we're still active interpreters of information.
Well, right. I would have thought that in your very first sentence, you would have started with that actually everything is immediately configured somehow by brain, eyes, etc., etc., and that's where we begin. And so here, I wouldn't think we get to any point of surprise. In other words, that's where the human begins. But what I think it can be helpful. I'm hearing Latin terms come out of you, and for the Renaissance, and I need to keep translating it. I take it
into
Greek, because in that which is clear will be eikon, okay? In other words, icon.
Yes.
And which is translated image, okay?
Yeah.
And so then the question is what we have with eidola in Latin.
Is it eidos? Eidos?
It will be eidos. So it's going to be working from the id stem of seeing.
Yes.
And we'll go into Latin.
But the interesting thing about eidos, and I never figured that out, but I think it's totally fascinating to think about how these words relate, because eidos then goes in the Christian language into idolatry. That is the false image.
Yes.
And also into ideology. Because ideology is, I mean, this was like the first critique of ideology, kind of came back to that ideology is derived from image. I mean, that the images that are produced.
And see, so, this is where Colossians 1 says the Son is the eikon of the aoratos,
the unseen God.
And not the eidos.
Not the eidos.
No.
It's the eikon.
The
icon. The icon that goes into Latin.
But that would be the
imago
image. The imago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's,
that would be the imago.
Yes.
The image. That's right.
There's a beautiful book, actually, on Greek aesthetic vocabulary. I think it's by Pollitt. Is it not? Do you know that?
No.
Which sort of tangles with all of these terms that often possess a kind of dual meaning, positive and negative. And now I haven't thought of it for a long time.
Yeah,
I think it's Pollitt, P-O-L-L-I-T-T, on Greek essentially Greek aesthetic vocabulary.
Thank
and you,
you
might find
thanks.
That.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, just throwing
no,
it
no,
out.
No, yeah.
I wish I'd come from here, but.
Thanks. That's very helpful. Okay.
Because what's interesting in Latin, all of these terms have dual meaning, positive, negative.
Yeah.
How you vary, but in Greek as well.
Yeah.
So
you mean each term itself has
yes.
both positive and negative.
Well, the thing
meaning.
Is that the concept, I should say, the concept does, just as you pointed out, icon and fantasia. They both refer to visual experience, but one has a positive and one has a negative.
Yeah,
valence.
But different terms.
Yeah,
one
yeah,
is
yeah.
positive, one
yeah.
is the negative.
Yeah, 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 yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
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 And so this particular selection in the New Testament of eikon is one, and then in Hebrews it's the apaugasma, the reflection of the charakter. Okay, they're trying to get away from copy imagery here, but a reflection of character.
Yes,
that
takes
us
into
the mirror.
It's all of the rest of the history of aesthetics, in a way, goes back to back to those terms.
That takes us to mirror discussion, which which was big a week ago Friday in the little conference that
I'm sorry, I missed it.
The mirror imagery. And then, of course, you immediately get into Paul saying, we see through a mirror darkly. And then the question is, what kind of a mirror is it? How clear were mirrors in antiquity of the time? Because they're perceived to be not very clear.
Oh, no.
Mirrors.
They were not.
Yeah. Mirrors are very foggy.
And that has meaning also for, I'm sorry, not to get into the Latin, the imitare.
Well, it's fine.
Also, which has a kind of hard edge to it.
It's fine. We just need to always keep...
Sorry about that.
No, sorry at all. Because they're feeding one another. Yeah. And the question is the stability. And if Christopher Nygren were here, I think he indicated 2 weeks ago that there had been significant debate in his area, where Titian is his major artist, about the specific use of the language. And and I think we're going to have an essay from him on it. And he'll be able to listen to this recording. At least he wasn't able to be here. But please go ahead.
Okay. Well, in any case, the mind will sometimes, often, will see things that aren't there, or not see things that aren't. I just have, for interest, a couple of.
Okay, sorry, just one more thing. Fantasia will be from phaino, phenomena.
Yeah. Phainai.
Yeah, phainomai. Yeah. To appear, rather than a perception of the actual image itself, which may not be visible.
Yes. Sure, that's right.
Uh-huh.
And when you...
And that's imagination. That's translated as imagination.
And when you do what we do...
It appears that way.
When you do what we do, which we read these texts, you know, funny black marks on a white background, that's what's happening. That kind of thing.
But it also has a lower ontological status. I mean, something
that's
that the Neoplatonists then pick up.
Aristotle uses the fantasia for what is translated into English here as imagination.
Imagination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's that which appears to the person.
Yes. Okay, so I just threw in a couple of visual examples here of how things seem to work. So if you look at this image on the left, what do you see? Most people tend to see a white vertical rectangle overlaid over a horizontal blue rectangle.
Yeah, that's what I see.
Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's the interesting thing, because in fact it's not really what it is. What it is, in fact, is a white vertical rectangle with two blue squares, one on either side.
Sure.
But the mind tends to imagine what you see in the right image, tends to imagine that the white one is overlaid over the blue.
Yes.
But in fact, it's not. Uh-huh. It's a white rectangle, vertical, and a square, blue square on each side.
And the second one, the one on the right, is a screen over it, right?
Yeah, well, it looks like. Right. And this is what happened.
This is all imagination.
Yeah, the mind wants to fill in what isn't actually there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, right. Or
Elizabeth Spelke has done a variety of experiments with babies in which she has stimuli that move behind occluders like that and measures the baby's reactions when the occluder is, you know, sort of slid down, and the baby sees suddenly that, in fact, it's just, in some cases, two things sticking out that are not connected, in contrast to a solid object.
Really?
And, of course, what she gets is the sort of surprise response when the kids see that it's not a solid object.
Really?
So it's an indication of what their expectations are.
Yeah. Elizabeth who?
Spelke. S-P-E-L-K-E.
S-P-E-L-K-E.
Yeah. I remember that study. I didn't know who
had done that.
Well, they've actually been, well,
Well, there's yeah. quite a number
there's
of studies.
Many
like
yeah. different ones. Yeah.
But she's doing it with very young kids, infants.
But she's actually doing, okay, she's doing flat screen things rather than things moving on a stage.
Well, to be honest, I don't remember the precise character of the design.
Yeah.
But
because some of them are stage objects.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, no. Most developmental research like this is magic shows.
Yes. Right. 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 Yeah.
Okay, and lo and behold, the kids are surprised by the magic.
Yeah, right.
So here's another one, same idea. Everyone can see the white square, except there is no white square. There are four three-quarter circles oriented a certain way. And if you turn the circles around, then the square disappears because there actually is no square. So it's just it's what we do. And I just threw in, additionally to this, a kind of an additional thing. This is how words might be imagined artistically. So this is Gospel of John, where two important words are phos and zoe, light and life. But I've seen this image where someone would write it this way and into this cruciform shape, you know, to sort of make this into a Christian symbol represented by two words like that. Actually, the person who I saw do this was someone I'm going to refer to a bit later, and that her name is Margaret Visser. And when I met her, she signed one of her books for me, and she wrote this in the book like this. She actually did.
Well, one of the things that should bring in here is the essay, well, a couple of essays, but the kind of classic essay by Larry Hurtado.
Oh, yeah.
That you know of that. I think I
know Larry, yeah.
On the first shaping of letters in or manuscripts toward pictorial,
like the word stauros.
Yes,
Where the tau would have the circle above to represent the head.
Exactly. So you have the cross there in Stauros, which means cross.
This is because our discussion yesterday, that would be an early depiction of the cross, actually.
That's right.
Because somebody said that we don't have like images of the crosses, but we have them in the manuscript.
This is where it could be safe.
Yes.
You know, we were talking about a safe depiction of the cross in relation to trophy, Roman trophy or something.
Yes.
And in the word cross, stauros,
yes,
it could be appropriate to have the cross embedded, pictorial.
Yes.
Yeah. You made a distinction early on, Mark, between the art of Christians before Christian art, say in the Roman period, and then subsequently a development of Christian art. When is it that the cross becomes an image that's out there in the art?
Again, this must be. I think the art historian does this pretty late.
Fourth century.
Well,
art in the third century, but not the cross.
But it's a suggestion also, though, isn't it, that, I mean, this is after crucifixion ceases to be a standard form of execution.
Yes, Constantine ceases crucifixion, and at the same time the image pops up.
Yeah, because no longer does it carry. I mean, it would be like people walking around with guillotines around their necklaces or something.
It's very interesting. There is, though, isn't there, some location, is it in Turkey, where there is about the earliest known baptistry or baptismal pool. And does it date from around 250? And it is a pool, and it is in the cruciform shape.
I think then they all, I mean, you have this, you are right. I mean, you see that in Ephesus, in St. John's.
But is it, it's not cruciform.
Well, it's human shape.
I have a photograph of one.
You have like the long thing, but because you go in and you have your arms, you have like these bulging things. You have a rectangle, and then you have these
round abscess-like.
Been there. Photograph. I'll have to go back and look at the photograph. I didn't think of it.
I have one too. It is in the same way as a trophy is cruciform. I mean, you have like the human shape like this is cruciform.
Yeah. I have a photograph, too, of this. I think it's around 250.
It has the arch. I didn't remember that part. I remember where you go in, you go, and then you go back
yes,
up.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah. But you have, in the middle, where we have in the church structure moment, we have the apsis, because churches also obviously imitate this.
Yeah,
there is. Right. So you have, like, you have two things bulging, which, well, it looks like this one, so like this. So that's the thing.
Yeah. I have a photograph at home. I maybe I'll scan it or something. Yes, very, very, very. All right. Well, let me go on to Ezra Pound, who was 20th century poet, literary critic, and a very strange character who. Who in Italy during World War II, he was an American, but in Italy during World War II made broadcasts in favor of the Nazis, and was arrested and spent many years imprisoned in a psychiatric facility. He was a strange character, but he was a brilliant poet and literary critic, and so he wrote in 1927 a little book or an essay really called How to Read, and in it he talks about these sort of three rhetorical powers of melopoeia, phanopoeia, and logopoeia. So there you see the fan in the phanopoeia.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There, right. So melopoeia is like musical or sound orchestration in words, uh-huh. like poetry, but also in prose, which frequently has a natural kind of melody or music to it. Phanopoeia, which is the point of interest here, is the casting of images on the visual imagination. Right. Then logopoeia, actually, as Pound describes it, is a more contextual and intertextual thing that depends on memory. So people recognize a word or a series of words, and so there, that's why, how they make their connections by memory. But phanopoeia, the casting of images on the visual imagination. And according to Pound, this provides not only a word picture or representation, but he claims it's evocative imagery that can create a flash of understanding, that can have an affective psychological event. In other words, he says this does something to you. That's what makes it rhetorical. It does something to you. And for
it's
Pound,
a performative. I mean, it's just one of the most important performance theories, really.
Yes. Absolutely right. Performative. That's right. And Pound even imagines that this has a moral effect. That is to say, it provides growth and helps people move ahead. Yeah. It does something to you. It moves you along because you see these things in the imagination. So I found this really a fascinating kind of thing. So phanopoeia demonstrates and examines how mental imagery induces an emotional response that moves people forward. And the ethos of the visually energized language elicits a pathos response. Images generate an emotional disposition of mind that leads to recognition and practice of points of view, beliefs, and behaviors. Which is, again, I summarize this by saying language does things to you.
Yeah.
Right? Does things to you. Puts images in the mind and all this does things to you. So for a long time I thought Pound was really very, very helpful, at least in getting some idea of this kind of thing. Now, the next one.
Yeah, already in, was it 2002, you introduced Pound to us at Heidelberg?
That's right, and I had done it in earlier work that I published even both that talk quite a bit about Pound as well. So he's kind of been with me for a long time. Actually, where I first heard of this, you may recall the late Professor Ben Meyer.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's where I heard this from. I went to a lecture once, and Meyer was talking, started raising this notion of rhetoric and Ezra Pound. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, at that time, it's exactly the kind of thing I was doing, was interested in. Mm-hmm. But that's where I actually first heard about this from. That was way back in 1980-something, I think.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. He's long since mm-hmm. been dead.
And that is so fascinating. I mean, come back to yesterday, this why have been images looked at so as something inferior, because we were on the logocentric level. We just thought ratio, not emotion. Yeah. I mean, emotion in this whole antithetical line is indeed female. So the ratio is male, and then women do images,
yes.
and men think and do analysis. And so this is, that's why this is so helpful, because it brings... reintegrates it.
That's what I think, too. Exactly.
I think it's also important about Pound that it's not ekphrasis. It isn't, and I was thinking about that in relationship to your opening remarks, where there's the entire tradition. I mean, Quintilian's a good example, but others in late antiquity writing that is meant to evoke imagery, mm-hmm. that is meant to mm-hmm. evoke palaces, scenes, settings, and which is a tradition that continues on. But what's important about Pound, I think, is... I'm sorry, I've spent my life actually talking about the power of images, and that they don't simply... that they are not simply discursive. They're not simply subjugated to text. What's important about Pound is that it's really the image. I mean, imagism is about constructing poetry out of images, but that aren't imitative. That is, that don't conjure up, in many cases, paintings. I mean, there's a whole ekphrastic tradition of that. So I just wanted to throw that out.
Can you just say in one word, how do you translate ekphrasis?
Ekphrasis is really an is to, in writing, conjure up, say, a painting, a piece of architecture.
The Shield of Achilles
is very famous.
Would you be willing for us to use the term describe? Because it is really an attempt. I mean, the first instance we have of ekphrasis of Achilles' shield is an attempt to describe scene by scene what is on that shield, and to evoke in the imagination what is on that scene. But you could go and actually check it.
But also, ekphrasis is also about things that are, in a way, fictions, which is also important. It can be fiction.
I show you a thing. Where is that? An Achilles? No, but it's in Virgil, in the Aeneid, in this scene, the battle. I said things that can't be put in words. I mean, and I...
Yes.
This is...
You get into the ineffable there.
Yes.
Which cannot be articulated.
Yes. So you describe the image. You just describe the image. But that is a surplus of meaning that you just have... is evoked through the word images. So that...
Well, just to answer the question, is that originally in the Shield of Achilles, it was this sort of blow-by-blow description, but it becomes also something that sort of approaches the fantasia, because you can also evoke things in the late Latin Silver Age. You get that. You evoke things that actually don't exist, but you evoke them so realistically that you give them energia and you make them exist before the eye, so that it evolves as a concept. But this
But what was your next step then? Okay, if we're clear about the tradition of ekphrasis, that it is on the one hand description, but then it can be description of something that is imagined and not real.
Elaboration is often...
Then what was the next step you were making into medieval
tradition? Well, what I was saying is, in terms of Pound, it's not the first case of ekphrasis, it's not the second. Pound talks about creating an event. He's closer to somebody like Dewey or James. That is, that it's not the subject, it's not the object, it's the event. It's a performance. In other words, he takes it even beyond. I think I don't know your work on Pound. I'm sorry, I've written about Pound too. I don't know it, but I will definitely read it. But I'm just suggesting that this is more than even just a Crassus and Pound. That's it belongs to a whole theory of the icon also is a kind of performative.
See, this is very important because the language of energia, in ergia, goes back to the discussion yesterday of the trophy, the trophy, and Niall Slater's point that the trophy that is depicted on the chemin, both of them, the trophy is in the process of being set up.
It's energeia.
It's energeia, and it is being set up at the spot of the present victory, which is to encourage going on and cleaning up the rest of the campaign. And then it interests me so much because there are a number of artistic pieces where the cross is being put up, and it is really very much the same angle as the putting up of the trophy.
So that is on the demo Augustia, you have the trophy that is diagonal. So, and then soldiers are pulling it up on strings and trying to erect it. So that the trophy normally stands on the spot where actually the battle turns. I mean, this is the exact spot where here the lines of the enemy have been broken, and now even if there are still a lot of fighting going on, this is we are victorious. So that you put that up, and that is the sign that communicates.
It has the body shield, usually a helmet,
and that's happening here. That is meant to be this flash of understanding, and it is to move the soldiers ahead.
Yes.
We're winning.
They see it.
Let's go. If we extended this, and if we even brought, say, to the New Testament, then it's moving people ahead, and this is what we might call social formation. This is social formation. So provides growth and helps audiences move ahead, even if the social formation is just now as you're reading the text.
We become a group that moves ahead with an action that we understand and is supported by
beliefs and actions, points of view, all these kinds of things
are brought together.
It's a kind of social formation.
Yeah, it's also a kind of positive thinking. You envision the result of an action as positive. And that is so important in the culture right now. So you just have to think positively about things. So you see the dead people all there, and they are just there. You see the empty breastplates and the shields. Everything is... The enemy is dead. Look at that. And you see it before your eyes, and then you continue fighting.
Keep going.
Is this like the story of Moses lifting up the serpent in the wilderness?
It seems to be related. Mm-hmm. It was referred to yesterday, and this can get us into a long discussion of the Gospel of John that actually takes the events that begin the sequence to the end back to chapter 13, verse 1, prior to what we call the high priestly prayer. In chapter 17. So we have an extended passion narrative, usually from 14, usually the last chapters, three, four chapters usually. Now it becomes 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20. It's an elongated one, but this has helped me understand that at 13:1, essentially the trophy is lifted up. And this is why then we can talk about the glorious presentation of the crucifixion. Mm-hmm. It is not defeat, as it is in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, or it is not death, but it's the, what's the language? It's the display of the doxa, display of the glory.
Glory.
So it's the glorious passion in John, in contrast. Now, I cut you off, Ryan.
I would just, this would be going way back to the point you were making with the contrast with a Crassus, and that this is a performative event. And I really, really like that. And I don't think this was your point, but I wonder if the distinction is so sharp. That is, I wonder if the performance, both for the reader, involves calling to mind, not just mental imagery, but actual physical imagery, but art, sculptures. And this would be more to your point. In your paper about the system side of Galatians, but also then for the author, that as the author creates this imagery verbally to evoke an imagination, a visual imagination, that author might be inspired by or drawing on actual material visual arts to formulate that. So I think, for me, I think there's just a more fluid interchange. It doesn't take away from the performative quality, but ekphrasis is never completely lost, I think, or at least a version of it isn't.
Well, it's an interesting point. I just wanted to get away from the descriptive notion and say this is not it.
Yeah.
And there is a level of reality here that you're creating an actuality, to go back to Aristotle, that there is this creation that impound. I mean, you create something really that doesn't exist before. You create it, and you co-create it with your reader, your viewer.
Yes. I like to think of it as supra-descriptive. Yeah. And that it's not descriptive, because it might be, or it might be drawing on descriptive elements, but it does more than describe. It has this performative and evocative element. Uh-huh.
But to me, the key thing here is that it is an energy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It is a thing in movement that is then translated actuality. Well, what is actuality? Well, it's an energy. It's a thing in movement.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It takes us back to Heraclitus, everything is movement.
Yeah, it is kinesis.
It's kinesis.
Kinesis. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I was just saying to Bob too, there's really a important neuroscience or neuroaesthetics component here too, because of the profound connection between the visual and the motor cortex. So that this is, you know, just a kind of undergirding. I mean, aesthetic theory is filled with that. Just the power of that conjunction, if you will.
Yes, and actually works in the body through, specialists in the room, through the synapses that put things into action, and the mind actually thinks through that neuronal system, according to
a kind of firing.
According to our colleague here. Yeah. Can't see his name right now. In psychology, he's doing
Larry Barcelo,
that the mind actually is thinking through the neuronal system, so that if I sit here and think of picking up a cup, putting it to my lips, and drinking the water, it's actually I'm able to think of that powerfully because my body knows how to do that without even thinking.
Oh yeah.
And you see a child grab a hold of that and put it over here and miss their mouth, and you realize what a coordinated set of things are going on.
Is this like what sometimes people call second nature? Like you just can do things? You know, where you can... Do you know that term, second nature? Where
sure.
You can drive your car and turn a corner and chew gum and listen to the radio all at the same time,
and it
just feels normal.
And wonder if you accidentally ran through a red light, or if it were
maybe
green.
Well, you can stop twice at the next one.
Well, no, but I mean, it was green, but you weren't even conscious that it was green.
I don't know.
What Barcelo is emphasizing is what he calls, in short, the notion that representation is always modality specific, and that there is not, I mean, he's arguing against a tradition in cognitive science of amodal representation, arguing that there isn't some fundamental language of thought in the mind to which all representations are brought, so to speak, but rather that representation is always in the perceptual systems, in the motor systems. There may be amodal representations as well, but they're not the whole story. And in fact, that quite routinely, what he wants to argue is that all these things are integrated, and any one of them is quite capable of evoking any of the others. So that, for example, if you're thinking about drinking the cup, that's going to evoke those motor potentials.
Yes.
It's what he calls perceptual symbol systems.
Right.
So does this notion of representation, this is kind of taking another view, but is that something like, is it Pelishan who asks these questions? Are there actual pictures in the brain somewhere or not?
I don't think Barcelo's committed to that view.
that's what I'm getting.
That's an interest that Pelishan had, that's right.
This is the last spelling of the last name is B-A-R-S-E-L-O-U.
S-A-L-O-U.
Is it A?
B-A-R?
S-A-L-O-U. The most famous paper is a paper called Perceptual Symbol Systems that appeared in Behavioral and Brain Sciences.
Perceptual Symbol Systems.
I mean, he's done a lot. That paper's actually now, I don't know, 12, 13 years old. Yeah. But yes. I mean, and he's done a lot since. But that's sort of considered the
what
landmark.
What is his first name?
Lawrence.
The other person I only just heard about more recently and who's long since dead is Maurice Merleau-Ponty, French philosopher.
Which
I have not read, but I tend to get to read that.
That was early on.
He's 68.
I think
he's
he died around 1960,
yeah.
I think.
Right. Yeah, he right. came, Something but he came like back.
Oh.
He came up
and
in
apparently, is there again? My colleague in psychology says, "Oh, yeah, this is very important right now, and some things that."
Yeah, well, there's a new phenomenology now, but also Abby Warburg, going back earlier, somebody was interested in pathos formulas. I did want to go back just and say one more thing, if I may, just because you started out with metaphor, that what Pound, in a way, is trying to invent or create with this flop, this hit, is really a new kind of language. I mean, it gets away from the point that this is just conventional or, you know, that you do it off the... you know, that you do it on your automatic or autonomic nervous system off of that. This is supposed to go through that. And shock you into the perception of something that didn't exist before.
Pound says, I didn't say it before, he said he was very much against what he called, this is his own, the loose use of bloated words that don't add meaning.
Yeah.
He wants it to be more like what you're saying.
Yeah.
Well, now I'm really wanting to ask if... metaphors we live by of Mark Turner and then Mark are in any are they
it's not
seem
Mark
to
Turner.
Me
it's
Mark,
it's Mark Johnson,
it's Mark Johnson and then Mark Johnson with the metaphors we live by and then Mark Turner teamed up with
Fouquet
and in all that discussion of metaphor. They are not bringing in this concept of the metaphor as event, are they? It seems to me this is absent. That the event, the action, is in the mind of condensing, of selecting, and of elaborating, of running the blend, etc. It's lit. When I hear this, it sounds like it's completely separated from this emphasis that Pound was trying to make. Am I wrong?
I did an SBL paper on a very similar topic last year where I claimed that those folks do such great work, but they're so interested in where metaphors come from and less interested in what they do. Rhetorically or for their readers. And I don't think
that's
they're incompatible, but I just think their focus is in...
That's what happens,
But I think record does that more.
That's an interesting claim. I mean, I guess I would say it seems to me they're very interested in what they do cognitively. They're less interested. I think you're quite right. They're not interested in what they do. They're less interested in what they do rhetorically.
And I was thinking particularly from the perspective of literary criticism how do we incorporate this in biblical studies and think about its effect.
But this has made it very hard to use some of this discussion of metaphor for interpretation of our text, especially when I work on the Gospels, where it's action, 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 and it wasn't clear how you interpret that information. And the irony is, as I read Paul, which is supposed to be this discourse, I have come to see that as really event-oriented and regularly creating a story and a storyline.
Okay, let me.
This is
great. This is fine. If we don't get anywhere
exactly
past this, is great.
May I make one request as an outsider? Because I have to leave, and so it might be inappropriate, but could we see the Colossian, the text that you were going to draw?
Yeah.
Could you put that up?
You wanna,
do you have the Colossian?
Why don't we jump ahead?
Do you have that?
Okay. Well, okay.
Just
I'll just flip through. I'll come to that right now. But let me. We were going to have Aristotle, Ezra Pound, and then guess who? Vernon Ramos.
Oh.
Yeah. Is where I was coming next with this, who talks about rhetography, and so there's some pieces there from Vernon.
Yeah.
Then I was going to come to Margaret
and
Visser.
The point there. Okay, now what I am perceiving in this discussion is foundational to my concept of rhetography were two things: location and evoking of storyline.
Yes.
Out of location. So you get a priestly storyline, a prophetic storyline, and I did not see the connection with Ezra Pound or with Aristotle with the energeia, namely things in movement, the kinetic dimension. And this session is very helpful.
But there you talk about evoking familiar context. There's where you're going to your storyline.
Yes.
Right. Exactly. But then I was going to come to Margaret Visser. I don't know if you know Margaret Visser, brilliant classicist. She was at York University for many years, but she writes these wonderful books, bringing things down to a level that people can understand popularly. And one of them is called The Geometry of Love, which is her description of a church in Rome. It's St. Agnese Fiore Lemura, which is St. Agnes outside the wall in Rome. And she has this beautiful description of this church, and rhetography and phanopoeia and visual thing is exactly what she's doing. And she puts it all into words. So maybe we'll come back to that, but we can still go ahead to Colossians. And then Daniel Kahneman, I was going to say something over him, and he sets these words, bananas and vomit, together, right? which is bound to evoke a reaction. And they're words, but the words put a picture in the mind of bananas and vomit, which simply don't go together, or something. In other words, there's a response from the visualization of the of the word. All right, but Colossians, maybe the best thing to do is if I go here to Colossians 2:11-15, which is on the screen, and then if I just, would this be all right to do this now, Vernon? Just go there and
absolutely,
and then I'll tell you something of what I think is happening here in the imagery. Now, this is very graphic imagery. I can't draw it, and I'm not sure anyone can draw it because it's so complex. But it looks something like this. Will probably take 10 or 15 minutes to actually read this. So the sentence actually begins in Greek at 2:8, and so we come to 2:11. And there's a bit of a shift or a step in the progression of images. So Christ is here pictured as the one in whom, so that's the first words, the in whom is Christ, the one in whom the listeners are located, but this image is elaborated, and there I'm actually thinking of ekphrasis here with its, the image is elaborated.
Are you going to read the verse through for us at all?
Well, I can.
I think it would be good for us just to experience it first, and then please your interpretation.
Okay. So, in whom also you were circumcised with a non-handmade circumcision in the stripping off of the body of the flesh in the circumcision of Christ, being buried with him in baptism, with whom also you were raised through the faithful action of God who raised him from the dead. And you, being dead in trespasses and the uncircumcision of your flesh, he made you alive together with him, forgiving us all the trespasses, erasing the record in demands that opposed us. He removed it, nailing it to the cross, disarming the rulers and authorities, disgracing them in boldness, triumphing over them in it. So this is partly my own translation where I've altered some of the language because this is what I think it's saying.
Yes.
Okay.
That's powerful. All right. That's
so
powerful.
So Christ is pictured as the one in whom the listeners are located, but the image is elaborated very graphically by casting the visualization of circumcision on the imagination. The faithful have been circumcised in Christ. The result of the physical surgery of circumcision can be readily visualized by people, if probably not literally examined in a church setting. We hope not anyway. But it can be readily visualized by people and would likely be recognized as a Jewish covenantal sign or by Gentiles at least as a Jewish peculiarity. The circumcision seen here, however, is visualized in a different way because it is made without hand. Non-handmade. Is made without hand, but nevertheless involves the imagery of circumcision in the stripping off of the body of flesh. And flesh here, quite clearly, is not the physical flesh of the foreskin, but is the metaphorical but still visualized cutting away of the body of flesh that is meant to portray the removal of the life of the former time in darkness and transfer into the kingdom of God's Son, in whom is redemption and forgiveness of sins, which is tying it back to those lines in chapter 1. The former life has been cut away, and the life of fullness in the apocalyptic Christ is now in view. This particular image of circumcision is the circumcision of Christ. That is, it is brought about by the apocalyptic work of God in Christ. Thus, while the listeners recognize that the picture, or I like to call it sometimes the retrograph, describes what has happened to them, they also see, as they have before, that Christ is at the center foreground of the portrayal and is the active figure in bringing about the circumcision. His apocalyptic presence is the visual indicator of the reality of their circumcision. Overlaid or interwoven with the picture of circumcision is the picture of burial and resurrection of the audiences with Christ, which picture is itself interwoven with the image of their baptism. You get kind of a double interweaving of things here, or triple even. The circumcision of Christ not made with hands, the stripping off of the body of flesh, is seen together with the burial of the listeners with Christ's burial and resurrection, There's burial, then their death is implicit, but their death is not actually mentioned explicitly until 13. But it's implicit here. So this is all, these things are seen together and is visualized in the recollection of the concrete reality of their baptism. In the visualization of their baptism, they will also now see their resurrection with Christ. Death, burial, and resurrection with Christ are seen as a complex unity in and necessarily with Christ. The actual burial and resurrection is brought about through the faithful action of God who raised him or Christ from the dead. The image of the circumcision made without hands is here visually explained. It is the action of God, performed in the same way that God raised Christ out of death. The baptism of the recipients of this retrograph analogously lays out the reality of God's action and of the circumcision of Christ. Okay. So there is an amazing blending of images in the picture. Physical circumcision is blended with a non-physical circumcision and with the cutting away of the former existence in darkness. Non-physical circumcision is blended with the audience members' burial and resurrection with Christ, brought about with God. The imagery of burial and resurrection is blended with baptism. This blending produces a quite marvelous visualized space where the circumcision stripping off of the body of flesh burial-resurrection sequence is seen comprehensively and at once. You see it all together.
It brings to mind in Egypt, in Karnak Temple, there are all these pictures of the people who have been conquered and of men who have been emasculated, and I'm not sure if it's circumcision or you know, they've been made eunuchs or what, in big piles of their private parts, and then it's in a scene of triumph, very like the cameo that you presented yesterday with Pharaoh on top with his chariot and, you know, all the sort of all's right with the world now. And it just struck me that there's also the huge lake for baptism or whatever they did for purification of the god king there at the temple. So, you know, they all seem like such a strange combination of images, but at the same time, it seems to me there is some kind of cultural resonance, at least in relation to that,
I would like to know where
I would like to see that.
Where could I find this?
What do you understand to be the significance or meaning of the circumcision in Egypt? I mean, Egypt is the other location where there's major circumcision, but I have no idea what its significance is. You know, we can talk about it in Hebrew
Except
Bible.
Except, wasn't it related to a coming of age?
Perhaps only that. I mean, perhaps that. I don't mean to say it. No, I don't want to. No. Okay, I see eight actions here, at least.
Multiple actions.
Circumcision, stripping off, which becomes stripping off, taking off of the earthly clothing in Gospel of Thomas and later things like that, and then going naked into the new age, the kingdom. I see baptism, number three, making you alive together with Christ, number four, resurrection. Five, forgiving trespasses. In other words, all of these are events. Number six, erasing the record. Seven, removing it and nailing it to the cross. Yeah. Incredible. Number eight, disarming the rulers, disgracing them in boldness, and triumphing over. It's a triumph.
You could even probably separate some of those out individually. Can I suggest that there are probably two circumcisions. There's circumcision, and there's also the not handmade circumcision.
Could I ask about that? Could one look at this, and I'm sorry, I'm coming at this from the visual, as, how do you say it, a haro poetica, that is, images not made by hand, the tradition of wonder, and miracle. I got into this because I've written on wonder cabinets and so on, these images not made by human hand that come like a bolt from the heaven, they're Poundian sort of images, they're performatives, they come, they happen, they stun you, and I mean, these are in a way miracles, aren't they? Aren't they wonders? And I'm just wondering whether that tradition might be infusing this passage.
Well, it just might. I mean, it's possible.
Because of that word, that non-handmade. Do you know what the Greek is?
Chiropoeto.
That's it. It is the not made by hand. That is the tradition of wonder. Which goes on down through the history of natural cabinets and so on, that is these things that are so marvelous, you can't comprehend them rationally, they have an effective power, and they are a performance, I mean, that come from elsewhere. So I just...
so interesting because in the biblical tradition of the plagues, it was God's finger making, dactylos.
Is that the word too?
That's the word for finger. And so Jesus then says, "If I by the finger of God cast out demons, then the kingdom of God has come upon you." And that finger of God imagery is from the Hebrew Bible, from Exodus, when the plague, when the plague became just unbelievable, all things were turned to blood. I think the magicians of the Pharaoh said, "This is the finger of God itself." And at that point, they gave
And you think the finger of God and the non-handmade is like synonymous?
It's the action of God. This is what I'm learning from this from this session. It's the action. It's the energeia. It's the and it is therefore the dunamis, the power, which you translate the wonder. You see,
gosh,
this is the power
lovely.
Of God.
Sorry, it takes me
because
back.
every time that the word miracle appears in English translation of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the word is dunamis.
The
power.
Okay.
And then this is changed in John to say mea sanctus.
Which means that the body of Christ, because all that happens to you because you are in the body of Christ, located, new location. So the body of Christ is a space of mystical, miraculous transformation. Mm-hmm. Where things happen to you that
this is where
that
this,
are...
This is the location, yes.
Yeah.
Was the finger sometimes a euphemism for the penis?
Can you leave your name?
Can you give us your name. Where one could find
you. I still have my University of Chicago email address, but Bob has it too.
Where are you?
I'm actually a Georgia Tech.
But not a
it's a focusing
way of talking.
Partially a Georgia Tech.
It's a focusing of the yacht.
But I still have my
We're discussing the finger of God in this. If it's
Barbara
in
Maria Stafford.
So is it BMS6? That's what it looks like on that. I think
that would make sense.
BMS6.
Yeah. Barbara Maria Stafford.
So. With double F?
Double F.
Oh, no. Okay.
Yeah,
she's an art historian.
Yeah. Written probably her best known book recently is called Echo Objects.
Echo?
Echo Objects.
ECO, like...
ECHO.
Like,
oh, okay,
echo.
Not ecological. Okay.
No.
Echo objects, okay.
It is, I forget, there's a word, and I just had forgotten, it's Etzba, and it is the Etzba Elohim or Yahweh? Etzba Elohim. So it is different, it's not Yah, as in
God. Yeah, with God, by the finger of God.
But it's not a typical word. It's very...
right.
That'd be quite uncommon.
And it is picked up in the Christian tradition, and it picked up in this saying of Jesus, if I by the finger of God cast out demons.
In fact, I think it's only used of God twice. The one example you're talking about, but later in the Exodus tradition, not in the Deuteronomy tradition, but the Exodus tradition, there is one case where the stone tablets of the covenant are said to be written with the
finger. That's what I was thinking.
Not always. It's not always
that
way.
That's what I was thinking of. Yeah.
But in one case, it is in the Exodus tradition.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let me just pick up with this again. Something I wanted to say about this. So, where was I? The blending produces a quite marvelous visualized space where the circumcision, stripping off of the body of flesh, burial, resurrection sequence is seen comprehensively and at once. The comprehensive vision is imagined to be located in Christ and brought about by the working of God. The imagery is highly complex, but the complex picture presents a reality that audiences of Colossians will grasp. And then here's the part I really want to mention. It can be understood precisely because it is a picture to be visualized. In other words, the picture makes the argument directly. Mm-hmm. And to me, I think that's kind of important. The picture itself makes the argument.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Uh-huh. Because simply the sequence of words becomes so complex, the mind cannot really negotiate.
So I say, how would you draw this? I don't know how anyone could possibly draw. Maybe, but how could you draw this?
Probably
at least I
can.
But artists. Getting all these things in the mind, and then this is almost like Pound's psychological moment. You say, "Oh, yes," and you, like you've got it from the picture itself.
Okay, may we ask you some more specifics? Questions about
okay.
this. I'd like
okay.
to ask you about the circumcision. You said there are two circumcisions here. So
the come into mind,
Okay. First of all, do you perceive that there is first an image of the actual circumcision of Christ himself, like we have in the Gospel of Luke? The fleshly circumcision.
Not of Christ himself necessarily, but of circumcision as an actual surgery or cutting. I think that comes to mind. I don't know if Christ comes to mind.
So do we begin? Are we beginning with Paul's concept in Romans, for example, of being circumcised in the heart
to start with?
Yes.
I don't think so. I think probably we're facing something here in Colossae where obviously the males in this church congregation are being pressured to practice this.
Right.
And so they have in mind the actual surgery.
Right. But now the assertion here is that they will not need to undergo that physical surgery.
That's where it's leading.
Right.
Yeah. It hasn't said that yet, but that's where it's going.
Philo also talks about a kind of circumcision that is not a fleshly circumcision. Mm-hmm.
But then he says this is wrong. You have to, if people don't want to get circumcised because of that spiritual understanding, wrong. You have to do it still physically.
They're saying.
No, Philo says it.
Yes, Philo.
Because there was a good kind of movement of spiritual circumcision also.
Right.
So that's interesting. So,
So this is, two circumcisions, the actual surgery itself, which I think they're being pressured about, and then the not handmade circumcision.
So your point is there are two images in the mind now that we have. We have the image of a handmade circumcision, and then some kind of image of a non-handmade.
Where it's been done, and it can be seen if you were looking, but it wasn't done by an actual physical surgical procedure by someone else on a man.
Oh, but you think we imagine that it is a circumcision.
Oh, it is done.
That,
yes.
That is.
You were circumcised with a non-handmade circumcision. It has been done.
Oh, it has been done.
It has been done.
You know, in the Gospel of Thomas, you know that Logion where they ask the Savior if it's necessary to be circumcised.
Yeah.
And he says, if it were necessary to be circumcised, the children would be born circumcised.
Oh. Yeah.
But so basically, the circumcision is the stripping off of the flesh.
Exactly.
And the flesh then, because that is also in Paul in Galatians, that Sarx double tasks as flesh of the circumcision
and this is,
flesh of
the blending.
This
blending.
Is stripping off, not the taking off, like the imagery of the clothing.
It's actually stripping.
It's apedukhnemi, which is the taking off of clothes. That's the same word.
Yes, sure. Yes, it is. But which means to strip, no?
Oh, well, but we could misunderstand it as like the stripping off of the skin of a banana or the stripping off of the bark of a tree.
Yeah.
This is the taking off imagery of the clothes, which is what you find in Gospel.
Upper ectiomai?
Upper ectiomai. Yeah. Well, it's more of a compound.
It is a compound.
You're the specialist on the clothes and being clothed with Christ. Mm-hmm. Is it regularly op ec, the double compound?
It's twice.
Yes, I think so. Is it 3:7 or 3:10 in Colossians? Is it there? 3:7 or 10 or somewhere near that?
It's the opec duramine. Yep.
Yeah.
In 10 you have then the enduomine.
To
put it on. So this is simply, I shouldn't probably use simply, but this is the taking off of the garments.
Removal, yeah.
And the body is the garment that is taken off. The body of the flesh is the garment that is taken off.
Yes.
And then you would say, and then ente peritometu shustu, so you would say, this is not Christ's circumcision, but this is circumcision that we undergo in Christ.
Yes. Ultimately performed by God.
So in the
I'm reading through the faithful action of God, which, as you can see, I'm reading that as a subjective genitive.
Yes. So that is circumcision of Christ. He is an objective genitive. So Christ, no, what is that? It's not Christ who is circumcised, but we are circumcised.
Yes. Yes.
So in Christ is the subject. Christ is the subject. He circumcises us, in a way.
Well, in a way, yes, but it's also brought about by the faithful action of God.
Right.
Sure.
But it is subjective genitive then, Christ's circumcision of us?
Yes. Not Christ's circumcision of himself.
That's right.
Right.
It's not subjective.
That's right. That's right. Christ is a subject.
And that is a signal of triumph. Is that
a signal
of triumph?
Well, it relates to it because the triumph comes up further down in the
But can you say something about, because this is very interesting, because there we get to the more political part of that. So how does that relate to the political and the social?
The triumph, you mean?
No, well, we talk about the circumcision now, and then why are the rulers and authorities involved in that? I mean, we talk about this.
It's saying, I'm imagining just now, because I haven't really thought of it in this way before, but I'm imagining that this is saying to these Christ believers in Colossae, don't worry about this pressure you're facing to do these things.
So. Yeah.
Because, in fact, you are circumcised by in this non-handmade, not even visible way.
Yeah.
This actually has been done. So everything's okay. So don't bow to this pressure.
Yeah, but which, of course, doesn't really solve the problem, because people outside the congregation would still say,
you
are not circumcised. This is just like a countervision.
That's part of the discussion as it goes on. You see in the next verses it says, don't let people condemn you about these things. And then when we go even here, you know, don't give in to the regulations, don't handle, don't taste, don't touch. Actually, don't give in to that. Maybe they do know you haven't done this, but don't give in to it nevertheless.
But this is such a strong argument, Roy, for what we discussed, that these debates about circumcision in Colossae is not just it's not about Judaism per se, but that the rulers and authorities want you to be circumcised,
so that you are back
in the normal order of things. So Gentiles.
Right. Exactly. That's exactly.
That are Gentiles uncircumcised and Jews circumcised. Yeah. So be either of these groups, or if you want to be Jew, but get circumcised. And then all of a sudden he messes it up and say, no, in the body of Christ we have this double identity. There are Jews who are circumcised and we are uncircumcised, but it's still one body with dual identity.
And it is located. You see, and where do you see it located? In Christ.
Yes. And that is the triumph, because you nail it to the cross. So where you normally have this plate, the kind of Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews, so that is the titulus. And then instead of that, you nail the new identity to the cross, and that, in this way, the cross becomes a trophy, in a way.
Yes.
Because
you become
victorious.
Quite right.
Is baptism part of that trophy or a way of talking about it?
Yes, everything is part of that. The dying, so you die. Normally when you die, you are a defeated enemy. Mm-hmm. So you are dead and out. But now the resurrection happens. And it doesn't just happen to a member of the imperial family.
But it happens to
the underworld people in Christ. Because Christ is an underworld body.
Yeah.
Somebody who is a defeated provincial and executed and criminalized and whatever. So everything down there, Tartarus, whatever you call it. And then out of that, well, just normally the Roman trophy would lead out of that underworld, but now the cross of an actual criminal leads out of that into life, and then, I mean, he has the chutzpah to call it a triumph. I mean, this is where he blends then the imagery of the trophy and the cross. You really, I mean, I had no idea, because here this, what I just was thinking yesterday about, here you have it, that the cross and the trophy are blended.
Yes.
But even circumcision of conquered peoples, which was done, I know in Egypt, I don't know about in other
yeah.
places, was a form of trophy that we have brought these people in chains. They have been circumcised, they've been made into slaves, they've been brought into order.
Yes.
They are now part of our universe.
Well, I mean, also in the Old Testament you have that. Doesn't David
yeah.
collect Philistine
yeah.
horses
yes.
and
yes.
just have
yes.
them
it's
all?
A trophy. Yes.
It's a trophy.
Yeah.
It's a trophy.
Yeah, sure.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
And Colossians says, no, that is... Stop that.
Don't do
yeah,
that.
Stop that. Because for him, and Roy, this is such a song, for him, circumcision is not just being a Jew, what we have
right.
constantly read that, but it becomes a trophy of Roman triumph.
Yeah.
If you do that, you submit to the Roman victorious
you have given
order.
It. That's right.
Yeah.
So
that's
it's
right.
no longer, it has a kind of, we have, because we have for ages we have read circumcision is only Jewish context, and we have not looked at the Roman context. But I think Colossians gives the Roman context.
Exactly.
I mean,
exactly.
this cannot make. I mean, we have, and I think we have constantly overread the rulers and authorities, because in a purely Jewish context that doesn't make sense.
That's right.
It doesn't make
yeah.
sense. So we just skipped it.
Yeah.
So we skipped off. I mean,
yeah.
we skipped the climax. Of the visual imagination.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
so in the commentary
yeah.
tradition, tend to spiritualize these rulers and authorities.
Yes.
They're somehow cosmic powers.
Yes.
And your
yes.
point is, they are the rulers and authorities in the Roman Empire who are establishing order
exactly.
through their.
In fact,
their
so much so that the word spiritual gets shoved in there. When we have stoicheia tu cosmos,
that's right.
Yeah.
Translated, only they want to say the elemental
yeah.
spirits
yes.
or
right.
spiritual forces, and
yeah.
spirits just is not there.
Yeah,
it's the stoicheia tu cosmos. It's the elements of the world,
yeah.
of the universe,
right.
of cosmos.
Earth, air, fire, water. Or
and
something
I
like that.
Actually
yeah.
mentioned this not here, but I mentioned it elsewhere and point out. You know, this is just a mistake, I think, and then. The language goes, you know, to principalities and powers, which then people imagine as being sort of
cosmic
beings.
I mean, all these different. I mean, then you go into the Gnostic stuff, and you have these
yeah.
different
yeah.
heavens, and they're just.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
so and then it's all spiritualized.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do anymore because the language, even in Nakamadi, I think the language is exactly political. But we have even there we have read it because if we are in Gnosticism, we are in a completely apolitical.
Yeah.
area, and then we were fine too. We have everywhere, it's just spiritual
yeah.
things.
Well, so much of that material in the Nag Hammadi literature is really dealing with asceticism
yeah.
rather than more spiritual kind of thing. You know,
yeah.
like practices in this world in relation to the materiality of this world.
Yeah, so, but I mean,
that is not really even so much spiritual. It's a matter of the issue of how transformation
uh-huh.
occurs
yeah.
within the material world in such a way
uh-huh.
that people have the potential for participating in what appears to be significant fullness outside of
yeah.
this realm.
Yes. So it is bodily.
It is bodily
yeah.
issue.
Which you find here, again, in Colossians, somatikos is repeated.
Yeah.
Bodily.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Well, I'm very I think we have talked so much. Can you just give the kind of the roundup of that?
If I try to get here through verse 15, that's about... three more pages. we got time for that? I just read.
Yes, we have. We have about 27
okay.
minutes.
Okay, let me just
yeah.
go through this then. Okay.
Marathon. People, pardon.
I need to leave a quarter of my
clock. Okay,
yeah.
all right. We have 26 minutes.
Okay,
yeah.
okay. So going along then. So what I'm saying then really is coming to this. the picture makes the argument directly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The picture makes the argument.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very important piece about rhetography and visual exegesis, that pictures can make argumentation. Yeah. Okay. So the image of death becomes finally explicit in verse 13. And so you can see it there. Finally in 13, you were dead. We've already talked about resurrection. Now he comes back to death. The Christ believers in Colossae remain at the center of the visualization, but now are viewed in their former condition, that is, prior to being raised with Christ, as dead. And following the circumcision imagery, they are viewed in their former condition as being uncircumcised. Mm-hmm. And I put uncircumcision in quotation marks, and call it uncircumcision. The word is, it's in fact, akrobustia. It's not aperitome, it's akrobustia, which is it's like it's a pejorative. It's kind of a swear word, and it actually means foreskin.
Yeah.
Or the technical term is prepuce. It's like Jews would use this as a pejorative against Gentiles. They say you foreskins.
Yeah.
It's got kind of a dirty word.
Yeah.
Really, it's like. Pardon the expression. It's like calling them pricks or something like that.
Yeah.
You know. Sorry about that, but I mean that's the idea.
Yeah. And Paul uses it all the time.
All the time. Absolutely.
At paritome.
Again.
He always says akrobustia.
But he also does use on occasion aperitome, which is not circumcised.
Not circumcised. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
He even has gospel of akrobustia.
Well,
I mean, that's.
I hate to do this, but it's going to slow things down. But going back to what I take it you took to be sort of the central claim, I have to say that is to say that the picture makes the argument.
Yeah.
I'll make two observations about this. The first is that. To the extent that the picture makes the argument, and I mean an argument in a technical sense means that there are premises and a conclusion.
Mm.
And to the extent that a picture can make an argument, it's not a picture. It's got to be something more like a movie. And I'm quite struck by the fact that Vernon pointed out that there are, 10 actions or something in this portrayed, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's something much more like the structure of a narrative. Rather than if I can just use these analogies, I mean, it's not a still frame; it's more like a video, right?
Yes, agreed.
A crucial footnote, though, and that is that a book that I think is just terrific. It's a little book that is old now and out of. Sort of not terribly current. It's in many ways it's a fairly superficial treatment. But in Neil Postman's wonderful book, The Disappearance of Childhood, one of the things that he explicitly argues in that book is that pictures can never make arguments in the technical sense. That the processing of images is not the same thing as the processing of text. So I wonder if your assertion the picture makes the argument is itself a metaphor.
Okay. Sure, I'm using the word picture. I suppose I would be happier, in fact, with film or movie or theater or something. Would that...
Yeah, well, that's the first observation. I mean,
yes.
If to the extent that this is... You know, argument is a term that can be used very broadly, and there's a technical sense of it that I was alluding to.
Yeah.
But if it's used more in the sense of the argument of a narrative, then sure. I mean, narratives are going to be something we associate with film narratives, right? I mean, that is to say a moving picture.
Yeah.
You got movement back in there, by the way.
I'm very happy with that. And in fact, that's, in general... That's how I've imagined this rhetography term Vernon uses. As always, something that is active, it's being played out. It's not a still painting or a still photograph.
Well, 10 actions.
It's always in motion.
Yeah.
This is all moving stuff here. So we're actually when he says buried with him in baptism, he means you are actually now recalling this. You can see the action of it. Yeah. And so the movement of it is part of the story. Yes, I think that.
And I think what makes sense in what you say is that I think he uses it as a metaphor, or a kind of, in a very loose sense, as argument. And the argument would be to compel these people to see themselves in a new way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So this is like a transformation. So you have a kind of a changed perception of yourself.
Yeah.
Who are you?
But it's the use of the term argument that I take to be the concern here.
Yeah, yeah.
It's
right.
It's persuasion right. through narrative sequence.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. And that's really what I mean, I think.
Persuasion.
And that would be maybe
yes.
a better way
argument
of saying it than
can
using
also
argument.
Be used as synonymous to persuasion.
Well, I think that's the question
yeah.
here. If argument is understood, I know people who distinguish between that, and an
yeah.
argument is one thing. You can be persuaded without
yeah.
argument, and I think that's
yeah.
what we're exploring here.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
your earlier quote on the movement of the feelings, of the emotions, I think it's that kind of persuasion
yes.
more than a logical.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. It is meant to affect the emotions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
just yeah, I'm with you. I just wanted to clarify
that.
I
don't appreciate that.
Metaphor.
I appreciate that.
I
think that's right on.
Okay.
I think that's right on.
Sorry,
yeah.
didn't mean
noodle. No, that's great.
Down.
That's great. Yeah. So here now we come to 13. The movement is here. Is the movement? It is from death to life.
Uh-huh.
Right. From death to life. Yeah.
I have to ask you. Yeah, I'm sorry. Is it real death? It's
oh.
death in trespasses.
It is a metaphorical. Again, it's a kind of a metaphor. Isn't it?
It's kind of like a
so,
non-mortalized physical
this,
body
this,
death.
Exactly. It is a bodily paraptoma, is a bodily word. It means something like beside the body. Para, yeah.
Is it like those people in the underworld who are being tortured and haven't been brought into
it? These images
yeah,
totally flood my brain right now.
Yeah.
So the kind of, you were dead sitting in the underworld or sitting on the lower level of the great cameo or the whatever. So, and now, this would immediately link to the rulers. Demands that are
okay.
nailed
they're
to the
still
cross.
Chaotic
yeah, yeah. Okay, I see.
You're dwelling among the dead.
Right,
yeah.
Yeah.
Because we always read it in a totally Christian
yeah.
Register.
Yeah.
So we are, because of our sins, we were dead. But what if he has the Roman superstructure in mind, the kind of the imperial structure, mm-hmm. then you were also dead because you. Not only just because you were not keeping Torah or whatever, but because you were doomed. You were doomed in that underworld life.
So already
space.
On Earth they're walking around like they were down in Hades, actually.
Yeah, look
yeah.
at these images. What are you if you are a defeated barbarian nation? I mean, I don't know. I have never, it's just like the first time I'm thinking these two things together.
You're beyond the pale, you.
Yeah.
Outside of the
yeah.
order of the empire.
Yeah.
They are still living because, like, the people live in Sheol. I mean, or they are kind
yeah.
of. But it's like a life without life.
Mm.
A life with not real fullness of life.
Mm. Yeah. I hope I can remember all this stuff at some point.
I'm writing a lot of it down and you
okay.
can listen to
it. Oh, it's good, yeah. Or I might be phoning you someday and say, what was that again? Anyway.
Oh,
yeah,
I might have forgotten it.
Well, I know.
You can both listen to what you said.
We will.
Okay.
Yeah, we will. Okay. Okay. So, in this death, or maybe better, deadness, they are viewed in their former condition of being uncircumcised by the circumcision of Christ. And here's an interesting thing. Death and dead bodies in the Greek or Roman era were considered to be repugnant and defiling things.
Mm-hmm.
Like Romans do not like dead bodies. They don't like death. Although, strangely, Margaret Visser points this up, they didn't like death, they didn't like dead bodies, but what Romans did like doing was going out and having picnic lunches by the graves of their dead people.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was sort of like their property, and they would actually go out of the city to where the graves were. and have lunch out there. But these bodies themselves, they didn't like.
Their ancestors or their the people?
Their own family, family members who had died.
Family members,
Family members who had died. So, and family members were responsible to look after their own dead, like you had to do it yourself. The former condition of being dead envisions this detestable condition, and simultaneously with the uncircumcised condition is seen as being in trespasses, that is, in sins that cause one to lose footing. So the word kind of it relates to that, paraptoma. In other words, beside the body, because like you tripped or something, like something's gone wrong. The entire picture, or maybe I should say a film or a movie or something, the entire thing implies that they are alive in the present view, as they see themselves now. The implication is immediately explicit in the image of the audience having been made alive with Christ. The audience is viewed distinctly as being alive, although in another view of the same tapestry, they are seen to have been dead. The image of being made alive with him corresponds to the continuing overlaid image of Christ and believers. The now living Christ and the now living believers go together inseparably. The complexity of the scene increases with the addition of the image and tone coloring of forgiveness of trespasses that contrasts with the more sinister images of in trespasses and uncircumcision. Now the visualization brings Paul and perhaps Timothy and others back into direct focus along with the audience with the reappearance of the plural pronoun. Now we come back and we have hey men, the plural pronoun. All the time it's been you, now it changes to us. So Paul is now himself back in the scene. The broader focus on we and us pictures the forgiven senders of the letter and its audiences as liberated people in a liberated setting where no authoritative record or authoritative powers, whether they are cosmic or, I think, human political powers, none of them stand against them or make requirements of them. The record of human actions that people imagine to stand against them is seen to have been erased. There is a blank space where the record was set previously, and the powers have been disarmed. The action of erasure is visually described as accomplished by God's action of removing the record, which... the action of erasure is visually described as accomplished by God's action of removing the record, and this is, how do you say, ata herikon ek tu mesu, literally, he took it out of the middle. He took it out of the middle. That's the erasure. Thus, idiomatically, he removed it by nailing it to the cross. The cross and nailing imagery places Christ at the center of the scene, since it's obvious Christ is the one who was nailed, and imagines the action of nailing as the metaphor for the action of erasure or removal of the record of rules that stood against people. This vivid activity, which is nailing, crucifying, erasing, removing, all those things, is simultaneously visualized as a disarming and a disgracing of and a triumphing over the adversarial powers and authorities. Simultaneously.
Regularly crucified.
Yes.
So the complexity of the picture is striking. It's striking because you have several actions being viewed simultaneously. All together. So again, I don't know how you could possibly draw this or film it, really, but it's still what's there.
But you do have a sequence of events. I could imagine a kind of ethereal mode of presenting it where you know it's moving through a kind of shadowy, dreamlike mode, and then have this sequence of events.
Well, people have, this is interesting, so you have screens and TV screens. Sometimes you can have two movies going at
it's possible.
This is that simultaneous. It's just like, isn't it a sequence still?
You know, isn't it almost, I almost hate to say this, isn't it almost both?
It is
a sequence, and yet it's all seen together at the same time.
Yeah. Yes, that's true.
So it's why, again, this would be, at least I couldn't draw this. Maybe somebody could, but I can't, I couldn't do that.
To me, it's like a battle victory that you are visualizing and seeing, and then talking about the meaning of it for us.
Yeah,
you know, appropriating implications of public
politics. Which I presume has to be the case for any audience of this, even the first audience has to be kind of like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think over or underlaying it with the image of the Gemma or the great cameo would be absolutely fascinating.
Yeah. Absolutely,
it's almost like calling.
We are done. We have to stop now. Okay. I forget. I always think it's 12 o'clock.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Roy.
Thanks.
This has been absolutely fabulous.
It was a delightful session.
We're thankful for our sponsors, the Mellon Foundation Sawyer Seminar Program, the Department of Religion, the Graduate Division of Religion, the Institute for Liberal Arts, the Center for Mind, Brain, and Culture, and Ancient Mediterranean Studies.
Yeah, I mean,
and thank you so much.
Are you from?